Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Oh, hi! If you're looking for another spooky and funny podcast to add to your rotation, check out Anything Bones, now part of the Podmoth Network.
Hey, Boneheads, I'm Sophie Schwartz.
And I'm Caitlin Hart.
And we are the hosts of Anything Bones, the podcast where we talk about bones and bone-related topics.
Soph, what are bone-related topics?
Thank you for asking, Caitlin. This can be anything from mausoleums to murderers, famous skeletons to cadaver dogs.
Bone churches, mummies, serial killers. You'll hear about them all.
And sometimes we have guests stop by and tell us their favorite bony tales.
Check out Anything Bones on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, or wherever your little heart desires.
We release new episodes every Saturday.
Bone Voyage!
Under the lightless gloom of the winter solstice in London, 1994, we zoom in on a young woman named Delia Balmer who is cycling home from a long shift at the hospital. Delia makes her way up the porch steps as her shadow melts into the encroaching void of darkness. After turning the porch light on and propping open the front door with a brick, she returns downstairs to fetch the bicycle to bring it in for the night. As she's returning, nearly to the porch steps, the grizzled face of Sweeney appears from the bushes to her right. He shouldn't be here. But somehow Delia knew he would be, sooner or later. He stood before her brandishing an axe and menacingly says, "Come on in! I just want to speak with you!" Thinking quickly, Delia kicks the brick away from the door. She knew if they made it inside, her chances of survival dropped to zero. Now face to face with her attacker, Delia throws her arms up to defend herself, but it's too late. The heavy wooden handle of the axe came crashing down. Again and again and again the axe came down, shattering her left ulna, tearing two tendons in the other arm, and a compound fracture on her skull. Beaten, broken, bleeding, and in full defiance of his assault, Delia kicks back against Sweeney. He staggers backwards and slices open his hand on a knife.
"You fucking bitch!"
He screams as he raises the knife above his head. He plunges the knife through her breast and into her lung, and again in the thigh. He returns to the axe and swings again. As Delia raises her arms to defend herself, the axe catches her on the hand, and she sees her left pinky flying through the air, with the axe narrowly grazing the other two fingers. She falls to the ground, using the bike to shield herself from the vicious onslaught of axe blows.
"That's it. I've had it. I have had enough."
As she slowly curls into the fetal position, ready to embrace death as a sweet release, a heroic voice pierces through the darkness. The sound of the axe smashing against the bike frame had alerted the neighbor, a 21-year-old young man who came barreling towards him with a baseball bat. He starts beating Sweeney in the small of his back, doing everything he can to protect the woman under the bicycle. The attacker runs away into the night, leaving behind the knife, but the axe remained with him. Delia miraculously survives the attack after being rushed to the hospital. She's left with two broken arms, two stab wounds in the thigh and chest, a severed pinky finger, and a punctured lung. She's given 19 units of blood as the doctors desperately tried to save her, which is enough to replace the entire blood volume of an average person almost twice. This was not the first near-fatal run-in Delia had with Sweeney, nor would it be the last time she sees him. She would have time to physically recover, but psychologically she was a broken woman. For the next 6 years, Sweeney was a ghost. Nobody knew where he was or what he was scheming. Until in 2001, six duffel bags were pulled out of a canal, and what was inside would haunt those who discovered it for the rest of their lives.
Hey, Alex. Hey,
how come we never really talk to each other on this show anymore?
You know, I was kind of wondering that too. You seem to be kind of taking over the main speaking parts. I've had very little airtime.
Yeah, my bad, man. Look, here, I was thinking about something the other night.
Yeah, I was there. Are we gonna work through this idea, or are you just gonna keep making me think of it?
No, yeah, dude, I know. Like, here, I think we should work on it and figure out a way to incorporate both of us a little bit better.
Like what? We just have an actual conversation with each other?
Yeah, I mean, what's wrong with that? The only difference, really, is that I'm recording it, but we kind of do this anyway.
Alright, sounds fun. Well, what do you want to talk about today? I'll act like I don't already know.
Alex, I am glad you said that. Today, I want to talk about a guy named John Patrick Sweeney, otherwise known as the Canal Killer or the much more badass-sounding Scalp Hunter.
Dude, that is sick. I hate to say it, but that's actually... like, that could be a supervillain name.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, what if it was some sort of genetically modified Wendigo that, like, the X-Men had to go hunt down?
Oh, or it could be, like, the big bad of a D&D campaign?
I don't know about a big bad, but... big bad, but... It could definitely be a, what about, like, a raid boss for a Diablo-style RPG?
Yes, that one.
Well, that's too damn bad, Alex, because Sweeney is none of those things. He is also... not the same Sweeney as the guy who strangled Dominique Dunne, played Dana Freeling in The Poltergeist. He just happens to have the almost same name as this other guy, and apart from that, nothing at all to do with this story whatsoever.
Oh, well, that's a relief. I can sleep easy now.
By the way, welcome to My Second Self and I am Matt, your host, the non-echoey one, and the other one...
I'm Alex.
Yeah, that's Alex. He is the voice in my head, and to you guys out there, he is harmless.
Hey.
Kind of switched up the intro a little bit today, but if you missed over the important part, don't worry, I'll go over it again here in just a second.
But we have something to tell you.
It's like a 6 out of 10 on the important scale, maybe, but look, I talk about true crime with the voice in my head over there.
Hi.
And we like to make jokes and references to nerdy shit, okay? We're not gonna pick on the victims or anything like that. This stuff really happened to those people, but there's lots of other stuff to make jokes about.
Like what?
Well, we're gonna be in Europe for this episode, so I'm sure there's some funny town names, maybe an interesting way to phrase something. I get to try and fail at doing an English accent, so you get to suffer through that. See, that would... Somebody, if you can tell me what that was, I would be very appreciative, because I don't know what accent that was.
If we force ourselves to talk like Ricky Gervais, it's sort of possible.
Yeah, but I can only do it for like one sentence at a time. Anyway, let's get on with the rest of the show here. Do the rate and it always goes into Australian. Do the rate and review stuff, 5 stars, yada, blah, 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 whatever. Just do what you want. Look, chances are if you're listening to the show, you know me anyway. So enjoy the next half hour. Ha ha ha! Welcome back to the show, everybody. We are now in Kirkdale in Liverpool on October 13th, 1956. Oh man, the sights of Europe. Looking online, just the look of this town today. It's so picturesque. There's so many different colors you can see. I've got to get over there one day. This is where John Patrick Sweeney was born. Now, I wasn't able to find a ton of information on his childhood, but I do know that he spent his younger years in a little town northeast of Liverpool called Skelmersdale, with his father, mother, brother, and sister. Dad kinda has the same role in this that he always seems to take in these stories. Abusive, controlling, domineering, you know, that whole thing. He held a lot of traditional values towards life, you know, how to go about it, what jobs a man should do, how women are viewed, etc. And from a very early age, this was the type of behavior that the not-yet scalp hunter would pick up as acceptable, or normal, or correct. Men are supposed to be strong, in charge of the household, bring home the bacon, set the rules in place for everyone to be happy, and women are just supposed to do what the man says and be happy with it. I'm gonna go to work in the factory for a long time, every day. I'm gonna come home and you're gonna have dinner ready, and everything's gonna be fine, right? Don't touch my tools, don't touch the fucking thermostat, just keep the house clean, and don't burn my damn dinner and everything will be fine. Okay? Which, yeah, makes a lot of sense. You don't want women getting too much freedom, you know? Otherwise, they might start thinking for themselves and having all sorts of ideas, trying to contribute to society or
Worse yet, getting all artsy with the stuff in my home? Hell no, you just stay in the kitchen till I need y'all, right? I'm obviously just kidding about that. Let's fucking go do art together. You don't have a job? Cool. Want one? Go for it. Need a better one? How can I help? Whatever. I don't really care what you do if we're together. We're still two separate people with individual interests, so you do you, I'll do me, and then we'll meet back home later to talk about our day, and then do each other or whatever. Okay? I don't know. It truly is a shame Sweeney was raised this way, considering that he had a penchant for artwork.
What did he draw?
We'll talk about some of the drawings here in a little while, but, you know, it makes me wonder where his art might have ended up, or where he might have ended up, if he had been properly supported with his artistic endeavors. Maybe none of this would have happened if he'd actually gone to art school, which is, that's something I share similar thoughts on with a different thing in European history that kind of sort of parallels this. History buffs know what I'm talking about. He'd gotten pretty good at drawing and painting, too. He was incredibly creative, and during his free time, he dove straight into his art, drawing anything and everything that came to his mind. And I'll tell you right now, it was a lot of stuff that came to his mind, and he was not shy about what was in there. He briefly thought about going into art school, but ultimately decided that he's going to go to carpentry school instead. Dad wouldn't take too kindly to me going to art school. That's not a manly man's job. You know, a man's got to do what a man's got to do. Manly shit, like building things with my manly working man's hands, or fixing stuff with my manly working man's hands, or getting into fights with my manly working man's hands, or manly working man's axe, which is a thing that definitely happened. Regardless, he, or maybe someone on his behalf, decided art school wasn't worth the investment, as it's not a manly thing to do, so off to go learn woodworking instead he goes. During that time, it is believed that something happened, and that's when he kind of made the change into the tarantula-esque psychopath that the rest of the world would soon come to know. That'll make sense later. For now, he's busy honing his skills as a carpenter, just hammering nails all across Europe, to Germany, to France, and Netherlands, ripping up floorboards in Belgium, all sorts of places. Really quickly, back to that axe thing from a second ago. There was some sort of altercation outside of a fish and chip shop where some dudes got into a fight. The cops were called, and when they arrived, somebody had been brandishing an axe.
I wonder who that could have been.
I don't know. Seems like an axe might be the type of thing a carpenter or a woodworker might have on them. I've never worked in that kind of field before, I don't know, but seems like there'd be a decent chance you'll need to chop something at some point if you have lumber jobs waiting to be done. You know, manly shit. Should be no surprise that Sweeney would have multiple run-ins with the law, most of them because of his very violent nature. See, here's the thing about John Sweeney. He is very angry and an extraordinarily violent person. He has got a lot of pent-up rage. Whatever happened in his early years at home or out during his travels, maybe a collection of everything, John's got a lot of control and power issues. He has to be in control of every aspect of his life, his job, his finances, his appearance, how people see him, etc. And if things don't go his way, as things in the real world so often don't, he has a tendency to react with poor judgment and violence, a combination you definitely don't want to be on the receiving end of. After traveling around Europe for about 5 years, give or take, he moves back home to Skelmersdale. I really like that name for a town. Skelmersdale. That's cool. And he meets and marries a young woman named Anne Bramley. For the first year, everything seemed to be going pretty well. He was like a knight in shining armor, always there when she needed him and always just showing her just how much he loves her in different ways. Until, as it always does, the violence slowly started to trickle in. Sweeney wanted nothing more than to be in control. He viewed women as his property, like he owned them, like they owed him something for him being around to give them what they need and keep everything safe. That's a man's job, it's a manly thing to do, that's what I got. So anywhere you go, I'm gonna go. Anything you do, I'm gonna do. I will always be there for you. It is suffocating, and it creates this incredibly unstable power dynamic that always puts him on top and her below. Until Anne had enough of his violent outbursts, including him throwing bricks through windows, lots of screaming and yelling, punching her, assaulting the pet turtles. John, why?
You did what?
What possible good could come from you hurting the turtles? What point could there have been to fucking prove? It's just sitting there in a tank. Why the turtles, John? Filbert didn't do anything to you, okay? He's just chilling in his tank, basking on a heat lamp, and you beat up a turtle. John, why would you do that? How would you abuse a turtle in the first place?
Too bad they weren't the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, Donatello would have whacked him in the head with a bow staff and none of this other shit would have happened. A happy ending with no murders and a reformed violent bigot, all because a few turtles with samurai gear showed him the way. I wish that's how these stories went sometimes, but nope. Somehow or another, he did some kind of harm to the tiny turtles. Seriously, what is it with psychopaths and causing harm to small animals? Animals. I'm fucking 4 years old. Leave the aminals alone. You're supposed to save the aminals, John. Not use them for disc golf or whatever. I don't know. Let's move on from the turtle abuse. Among other reasons, the vicious turtle assault caused a rift between them, and they were divorced for a couple of short years. However, ever the charmer, Sweeney sweet-talked his way back into her good graces, and they were remarried in 81 and also had a couple of kids together. Why not? Things are going great. Let's throw in two tiny people into the mix. From here, the violence would trickle back in slowly but surely, and with an ever-increasing frequency and intensity. One night, after she'd returned home from a major surgery that he beat her so hard and so savagely and so ruthlessly that he actually popped her stitches back open.
God damn, John, at least let the scar heal.
I just had a thought. I wonder if that was some kind of weird control thing for him, too? Or, like, maybe he was mad that she wasn't back to full health yet?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, it's her fault. She had the surgery, not him.
Yeah, hurry up, lady! I'm hungry! What the fuck, man? I assume she had to go back to the hospital for that one to have the stitches redone. I don't think that's something you could have figured out, you know, in the bathroom at home. But this was also the last straw for her. She and John separate, and he finally moves all the way out of her house. All right, I'm going. I'm fucking going. Don't get your onions all bunched up in a knot. And I'm taking my damn tools, too. You ain't know how to use them anyway, you dumb bitch. Yeah, that's right. Good luck fixing your cabinets after I yank all the damn screws out, too. Alright, so, I think we can all agree that this is pretty rednecky or white trash behavior, and since I can't do a very good English accent anyway, I think Sweeney's just gonna have a dumb southern guy accent, cause it's easier and more fun to do!
Amen, brother.
Until one night, Anne is hanging out with her next door neighbor at her house. At her neighbor's house, not Anne's house. Kids are off doing their thing somewhere, and the ladies are upstairs having tea and biscuits, or some other English ladies in the evening type of activity, when she suddenly hears a very strange sound coming from next door.
Next door? Do you mean her house?
I do mean her house, yes. Something is going on inside of her house, some knocking around, making all kinds of noises and squeaks and clanks. So Anne, having a brain and very recent memories, calls the police. Yay, Anne. Something in her mind just said, this doesn't feel right. And she was probably as relieved as she was terrified that she called the police, because when they went into her bedroom, Sweeney was hiding in her closet, holding a claw hammer in one hand and a fucking axe in the other hand. Oi! What you doing in here, John? Got a nail that needs chopping.
I was just preparing a little something for my wife.
He said he was preparing something for his wife, John. Come on, man. That's clearly a lie and not a great one. He was more than likely going to end up killing Anne if she hadn't called the cops, so fortunately, he is arrested for this, but unfortunately, domestic violence just wasn't looked at very seriously back then, so he is released on the very strict and therefore reasonable condition that he stay the fuck away from Anne. You better not go anywhere near her, you little shit. You hear me, you son of a...
Matt!
Yep, I'm back. It's cool. Sweeney moves back to London, and Anne takes the kids, and they all go to Northampton, Anne and the kids. And they stay safe throughout the rest of this, because while in London, Sweeney has been keeping himself busy. He's got all sorts of work lined up for him, utilizing his carpentry skills, making a living doing honest manly man's work, working with his manly working man's hands. And in 1986, he's working on the set of a photo shoot one day when he meets a very beautiful young model from Ohio named Melissa Halstead. She had been working for the Ford Model Agency since the age of about 15, and she'd spent just a little bit of time in Paris and then eventually made her way into London, where she ends up meeting Sweeney through a friend. For Sweeney, she was the perfect target. He saw a young, easily manipulated, naive girl in a foreign country who had very little support network and few resources at her disposal. All Sweeney had to do was put on just a little bit of charm, and she was swept completely off her feet. Just like Anne. And all Melissa saw was a rugged, charismatic, and charming European man who could help protect her in an unfamiliar world. It didn't take long for the two to move in together, either. Much like with Anne, things started off totally fine. Flowers, chocolates, presents, he built some cupboards, he even built her a bed that she couldn't afford, that's a baller move. Doing everything he can to make himself indispensable while simultaneously breaking her down and whittling away at her self-esteem so that she's too scared or too tired to try to ever escape from him. Melissa's sister, Chance O'Hara, came to visit Melissa and upon meeting John Sweeney had an instant dislike of him. You know, sometimes you just see somebody, like maybe you're out and about doing some adult nonsense and like going through the store and they just give off this weird vibe like, yeah, I don't think that person and I would get along very well. Not to mention, all the weed and psychedelics and other drugs just scattered around the apartment. Melissa's sixth sense was going off on Sweeney for sure. That's a thing that people definitely have, and it is a shame that Melissa didn't seem to have that sense. And surprise, surprise, Chance was absolutely right about Sweeney. We already knew he didn't treat her very well, but some of the things he did to her just adds a whole new layer of dread. We understand the yelling and the screaming and the punching holes in the walls, but he also said some really, really horrible things like, "You have to do everything I say, I'm in charge of this relationship," you know, things like that. He was arrested 3 different times for screaming at her, punching her, and throwing a huge chair at her and injuring her leg. All the while screaming more and more scary shit like, "Who do you think you are? I'm the one who says what you can and can't do." How do you get to the point of chair throwing? What? And then to add literal insult to injury, he was also only given a slap on the wrist for these incidents and only had to pay a fine of £5.
Are you kidding me?
Melissa was talking to her sister on the phone one night after an incident where Sweeney scared her with a knife. I wonder how many of those phone calls there were. Not sure how far it escalated, but it involved a knife, so that's scary enough on its own. During the conversation, Melissa told O'Hara, "If I ever go missing, it means that John Sweeney would have killed me, and that he threatened me and he would kill me and no one would ever find the body." In 1988, Melissa's work visa runs out and she gets deported for working in the UK without a permit. How dare you? Just kidding. And moves over to Austria, specifically in Vienna, a city most famously known for its little sausages. They actually invented that little pull-tab thing on the top of the cans of Vienna sausages after figuring out that while storing meat in an aluminum can was the best method of preservation, they were just a little too small to work with your standard can opener.
And when they're cold, it comes out like cranberry sauce at Thanksgiving.
She and Sweeney had been separated at this time, but he, of course, hears about it because he has to know everything, otherwise he can't have the control he wants. And the order to stay away from her only matters in Britain, so since she's not there anymore, he tracks her down, breaks into her flat, this is top-tier psychopath shit, ties up her housemate, and then starts trying to find evidence somewhere in there that she's been unfaithful. Dude, you're not even fucking together at this point. What are you doing, John?
Seriously, man, he's like an international stalker with a big axe. That's terrifying.
And he's unhinged and angry, and in his mind, this is all her fault anyway, so he's gotta do what he's gotta do. Which is, I guess, to correct the behavior with violence. I'm pretty sure the flatmate survived, but pretty rattled. Melissa bought Sweeney a ticket to Amsterdam, after she finally managed to convince him to leave. Like, "Look, dude, just go away. Here's a ticket to Amsterdam. I'll go away." And that gave her just enough time to cool down for a couple of days, until a few days later, Sweeney winds up on her new doorstep. "How'd you find me, John?" begging and pleading. "I've changed. I'll treat you better. I've learned my lesson. Besides all that, you need me. You don't know how to do anything in this place. You don't know where you're going. You'd be in more danger if you don't take me back. How would you survive without me? You? No. No, hell no. You're not smart enough or strong enough. Or, I don't know, whatever narcissistic sociopaths say to their victims. Probably in the ballpark, based on all the crime shit I read, though. And things go exactly as you might expect. Within hours, the same fucking day he came back into her home, he loses his shit, starts chasing her around the apartment with a hammer. This guy really loves his hammers. So, context here. My modern day American apartment is pretty small. And this was 30-something years ago, so I can't imagine it was much bigger than where I am, if not smaller. There's not a lot of places to hide or room to maneuver right now, so he does eventually catch her and wallops her with the hammer pretty badly. The police are called, and Sweeney is obviously arrested and thrown the fuck in jail for just a little while. John! John. John, I know you hear me. Stop it! Okay? John. John, stop it. That's basically all the punishment that he gets from the police for a long while on this. Meanwhile, Melissa, she's over in the hospital recovering from a very fractured skull from hammer blows. That is a fucking crazy weapon to use. Holy crap. And that's the second time he's been armed with a hammer. That's fucking crazy.
Were you able to find out what kind of hammer it was?
I think it's just a roofing hammer or a claw hammer. You know, the one you think of when you hear the word hammer, I guess, with the two little whoop on the back. I hope this doesn't damage my credibility as a podcast host, but I actually don't know a ton about hammers. I know there's a few different types, but I don't really know what they're for or what they're called. I know ball peen, roofing, claw, and sledge. Those are the types of hammers that I know. Sorry, I'm not a hammer guy.
Dude, it's fine. I was just asking.
So, if you remember earlier, I said that he was really good at drawing? Well, while he's in jail for the hammer attacks, he starts drawing again to pass the time. And if you thought he was drawing normal, wholesome, sunshine and rainbows types of drawings, you would be absolutely, completely, without a doubt, totally, 100% correct. He has one of a cloud that's just lovely. No? Not buying that one, Alex? No one out there buying that one? Good, because it was a lie. So was the Vienna sausage thing. And also a test. Good on you guys for paying attention. He draws some really, really fucked up shit. Alright? Like, one that's just a black and white background. It's just like a sketch, like just pen on paper. It's a body with no head, no hands, no feet. And it's just curled up over onto itself, leaned forward with the legs pointing backwards like a fucked up yoga pose. That's the kind of shit that he draws, because that's the kind of stuff that's in his head.
What?
Not only were these drawings incredibly violent and sadistic and just disgusting, really, they were also a direct reflection of the fantasies in his mind. The most alarming of his drawings was one titled, "A Romantic Weekend for Two in Austria." This is the most opposite of romantic you could probably be. It's a black background underneath like a yellowish moon. I guess it's a new moon where they look real big and orangish yellow in the sky. There's two little hearts with some faces on them, joined by like a thin line. If you look close, it almost looks kind of like the little hearts are kissing. But then you zoom back out a little bit and you see the very bright blood red silhouette of a man strangling a woman with one hand. There's no details on the body, just the outline, and it's all red. It looks like her head is thrown back, her hair's dangling in the back. I'm throwing my head back right now, it's hard to talk like this. And above him, on the other side of the painting, he's holding up a very long, very thin, sharp as fuck boning knife, ready to just start thrusting. If this were a movie, the very next scene would be that woman's funeral. Because they're not going to show that on TV, because that's fucking terrifying.
Jesus Christ, that's terrifying.
For real, what if you found a picture like that and it was about you, or there was some detail about it, like instead of Austria, it's where you went with your first date with your significant other, and it was just a romantic evening for two in Boulder, Colorado. I don't know. I'm out. I'm leaving. I'm not sticking around for that. Fuck that. Uh-uh. Unfortunately, Melissa didn't know any of this about John's artwork. In fact, she's so blissfully unaware of what John's been up to in jail, drawing through his emotions about how he feels about her, she actually goes to bat for him. She's been manipulated so much and just so worn down from Sweeney's bullshit that she convinces herself that if she tells the judge that he's better and she made a mistake and he has nowhere else to go, then things will be better. So she petitions the judge for clemency and he is released from jail. On one condition though, John, alright, you're listening? You gotta get the fuck out of Vienna, alright? You take your drawings and your little life and you go on, you get out of here.
Yeah, you tell him, Judge.
Next stop, a 700-mile road trip to the promised land, Amsterdam!
Woo!
Calm down, Alex. They aren't there for that. Well, maybe a little bit. But John had other plans, as we're about to find out. They get settled into their new home once again, and then in November of 1989, Melissa calls home to talk to her family. She hadn't talked to them for a little while. She wants to get a hold of them, check out for the holidays. It's Thanksgiving over in Ohio, where Melissa's from. But nobody answered on her family's end, so she left a voicemail. And that was the last time she'd ever call home. Now, the details of what exactly went down, we don't know. The best guess as to how it happened is largely left to speculation, but 6 months later, in April of 1990, Melissa's body is found inside a duffel bag floating in a canal in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. Somehow or another, he kills Melissa. Based on his drawings, one of his fantasies is definitely dismembering women, but we don't know how he killed her. Whatever he did, it was extraordinarily, extremely, extremely violent. He cut off her head, both hands, sawed her spine in half, and collapsed the body onto itself and put it into a huge black bag. That sawing of the spine in half part, that's the part that I have trouble getting through. I put it in italics because it's such a gross... I've never seen that phrase written anywhere. Until this case. That's nuts to me. Ugh. I don't know, moving on. Her family was beginning to become concerned as not calling home for over a year. Completely out of character for Melissa. Surprise, surprise. I didn't hear from my daughter in about a year. Where she could be. Most people call home more than once a year. So she was reported missing in Amsterdam. But since her body was discovered in Rotterdam, which is in a separate jurisdiction, no connection between the missing persons report and the body were ever made. The case was closed, and her body was interred in a local cemetery as a Jane Doe. Sweeney had gotten away with murder, and soon disappears from Amsterdam to avoid suspicion. I gotta get out of here, they are probably looking for me. He won't pop back up for another year or so with anything relevant. He's gotta go cool off for a little while. He just did something really, really bad. So we met the next person all the way back in the beginning of the episode, Delia Balmer. She was brutalized pretty severely in that opening scene, but that was the climax of their relationship. And I'd bet at least one person out there is wondering how she ended up underneath her axe-mangled bike in the first place with a missing finger. So let's go check out that wing of the museum next. So on this wing of the museum, a lot of the exhibits were donated with very specific details attached to them that, well... you just wouldn't find in any other learning institute.
Dude. What?
Okay, fine. Maybe I could elaborate a little bit better. That's a loose analogy. The two good videos on YouTube about this case are pretty much just an interview with Delia Balmer, but they have different visuals and emphases on different parts of John Sweeney's whole story, but there's lots of good information in both. And the museum bit just means that much of Delia's story comes from her own words during this interview, so that's where I got this information.
Yeah, you should have just said that.
She is still alive in London somewhere, and I really hope she's doing well. On the off chance that she ever does hear this, Delia, I really hope you're doing okay. Sorry that you had to live through what this piece of shit did.
So how did they meet?
So one day, in London, it's 1991, it's a Monday, likely dreary, overcast, and damp, if I know anything about weather patterns in England. Delia is off work, so she decides best thing to do that day is go down to Hawley Arms, a local pub, and have herself a pint. While she's there, she's kind of just hanging out on one end of the bar, not really paying attention to much of anything, maybe just swirling her drink around, and then she has this sensation like she's being watched, like, what's going on here? She looks around, doesn't see anything, and then she notices on the other end of the bar, way down there, is the man of the hour, John Sweeney. He's giving her the googly eyes. They lock eyes. She smiles. He does that little up nod and cheers motion, then starts making his way over. The two begin talking, and Sweeney tells her all about his interesting life. All of his travels over Germany and France and whatever, going to carpentry school, what he does for work, his carpentry skills, how much he can bench press, how high he can jump, how many people he's killed, just a total narcissistic stream of consciousness about all his best features, except for maybe that part about killing people. He hasn't said that part out loud yet. But while he's just kind of dumping out word salad all over the table, Delia is thinking, oh my goodness, he's a traveler. He gets to go all over the world. That's what I want to do. She's currently employed as a nurse in London, Delia is. That means she works long hours. People are probably rude to her for no reason. It's frequently gross outside. She lives alone. She's lonely. Maybe a little bit unfulfilled at work. I don't know if patients in London are different than patients in America. They might actually be nice to her over there, but if it was an American hospital, they would be assholes for almost no reason. And then, wouldn't you know it, out of the drab gray sky of London walks in this handsome, well-traveled, skilled, manly man's working man, and he's interested in me?
Oh man, I'm standing in a puddle over here.
Well, go grab a mop, because he's coming over tonight, and Delia has a very modest flat. We gotta get that cleaned up. She doesn't have any furniture at this point. You'd be able to see it and smell it the moment you walked in the door. Sleeping bag goes on the floor, man. Alex, we can't be sleeping in that mess. Anyway, he does come over that night, and she made tea for the two of them, and they just sat on the floor talking for a little while, just drinking tea and chit-chatting.
Wow, she's really rocking the recently divorced guy that's rebuilding starter set.
Yeah, right, the bed is on the floor.
There's only one chair in the middle of the living room, and the TV's on top of a milk crate.
The plate is in the sink, still dirty, next to the sink knife. Guys know that one.
The only thing in the fridge is a half gallon of milk that may or may not be bad.
There's a light in every room, but it's because she has to take the light bulb with her.
The bathroom is stocked with toilet paper taken from work.
If it were happening today, she'd have to wake up and reinflate the bed because it lost air in the middle of the night.
Yeah, next thing you know, she's going to be launching a podcast where she talks to the voice in her head.
All right, I think that's enough of the depressed single guy apartment. Hey! Wait a second!
Gotcha.
Actually, you know what? I can't even be mad at that one. That's exactly what I did. So that's how the two initially met, and kind of where Delia is at in her life. Then a few days later, she's just walking down the road. She bumps into him somewhere on Kentish Town Road, and he asks her out on a date. At first, Delia declines, says she's too busy and just doesn't really have the time to be dating anyone right now, but as the day went on, she started thinking more and more, like, well, maybe I have a little more time than I thought, maybe I overreacted. I get home at this time, so that gives me these hours I could spend with him. I guess I already don't sleep enough, so maybe having another person around would add to the quality of life. You know what? I'm being silly. I'm being stupid. I'm gonna write him a letter and give it to him and just, we'll see what happens.
Well, what happened?
Well, what happened is that is exactly what she did. She gave him the letter and, in her words, started something she should have never started.
Oh, fuck.
Think back to Anne Bramley and Melissa Halstead for just a second. I don't know how he actually met Anne, but with Melissa and Delia, it was both essentially just a completely chance encounter with these women. He met Melissa through a friend. He met Delia just when he was out at the bar one day, and then he uses his charm to work a foot in the door, and before they know it, he's in constant daily contact and just love bombing the fuck out of them, bringing flowers, chocolates, fixing windows, fixing the light by the window, fixing the cupboards, fixing to make himself so useful. What would I do without this man? That's what he's trying to get them to think and believe. And unfortunately, it kinda works. Like, it worked once for him somewhere in the past, and he just kept going with it.
What a tangled web of shit he weaves.
I'm really glad you said that, Alex. Check this out. One day, early on in Delia and John's relationship, he asked if he could bring over his pet tarantula.
His what?
That's probably exactly what Delia said and probably how she said it. Your what? But she did agree. I guess he did build me that cupboard and yeah, okay. And so he brought it over and that somehow wasn't the weirdest thing that happened in that house that day.
Oh Lord, what did he do?
He just kept asking for tea, sitting and staring at the tarantula eating a bunch of locusts. First of all, that is a weird food to just have around as pet spider food. And then he says this about it. This is his quote about the tarantula. It just sits and sits and waits. And then when they're unaware, it pounces. Just like the police. Remember earlier, way earlier, when I said that the tarantula-esque thing would make sense? This is what I was talking about. That's literally what he has done to every one of his victims. The love bombing, the niceties, the handyman stuff. All of those things are just pieces of the vile web he needs to weave to trap his prey. Then by the time they realize what they've gotten into, it's already too late, man. They're already stuck to the web. I mean, I just realized how perfect an analogy for psychopaths a spider really is. And I know, nitpicky people, tarantulas don't weave webs, but it just fits him so perfectly. Otherwise, he could be like a trapdoor spider. That's a good one too. They kinda, well, they don't really do webs either, but whatever, he's a spider. And also, a pet spider is probably also a pretty good indicator. People that have exotic pets like spiders and snakes are always a very interesting flavor of person. It's usually like a dedicated animal lover, a bored guy with too much money, or just some greasy dude that smells weird and has stains on the front of his shirt. He's like, hey, you want to see my pet tarantula? You can hold him if you want. He won't bite or nothing.
How do you know he won't bite?
I had him defanged a few months back after he ate my pet copperhead. Right around this point in the relationship, Delia finds out about John's interest in artwork. Man, this guy just keeps getting better and better. He does all that other nice stuff, and he's a talented artist. How lucky am I? I mean, the spider thing's kind of weird, but maybe that's just the thing artist types do. You know what? I'm gonna see how this plays out. And next week, it plays out pretty poorly. Holy shit, the things this man draws. Specifically, the one that's clearly a self-portrait of himself next to a pretty other woman. John, who is that woman? That was, of course, Melissa. He told her that they'd split up, but didn't say anything about how or why. Still kept the picture, though, which is weird, John. That's weird that you kept that. Some of the other things he drew were much more disturbing.
Is it more disturbing than the last one you talked about?
Believe it or not, yes, although it's kind of relative, but this one definitely feels more graphic. There were tons and tons of pictures of just chopped up bits of body parts, and if you thought the one from earlier was gruesome, check this one out. This is the one that stuck out the most to Delia, and probably me too. It was one of just him eating some spaghetti.
Regular, normal spaghetti?
Right. Regular, normal, totally not macabre or grotesque in any way. It's Monday night, and I'm too tired to cook after work. Easy dinner spaghetti.
Why do I feel like that's too long of an answer?
This was the furthest thing from normal spaghetti you could possibly be. He was eating spaghetti, but the noodles and sauce were coming out of his own head that was just opened up like a box. Like, you open up the tea box, and then you just reach in and grab one. And the noodles were spilling down onto the plate, like coming out of his brains, and he's just slurping them up. Just, yeah, I know, sorry, but I hate mouth noises too, but that fucking really sells it right there. What the fuck is he drawing? What is that? This is crazy. This is the stuff that goes on in this guy's head on a daily basis. Spaghetti brains and murder fantasies, which I think has to be the title of this episode now.
And tarantulas.
Maybe, that's kind of wordy though. We'll see. So their relationship goes on like that for a couple of years, bespeckled with weird drawings and spiders and some shouting and some building and some flowers and some chocolates and some yelling, and he's just slowly wearing her down bit by bit by bit by bit. By May 1994, this is about 3 years later, I believe, she'd finally managed to just spend a few days away from John, just to not be around him. She went out with some of her friends, and John didn't like that at all. This is one of the craziest ways you could possibly react to something, and this isn't even anything. She went to go hang out with some friends without him for a while. John, I'm gonna go to the library for a book club, and then we're gonna come back. It's over in Germany, but don't worry, it's only like a 45-minute drive. That's crazy to me that they can just go to different countries at a drop of a hat over in Europe, because I live in Texas, and it takes 10 hours to get out of this state, depending on which direction you go, so that's fun, but John didn't like that whenever he got back. She gets back home on a Monday night. And when she comes inside, he's already there. How'd you get in my house? Sitting on the bed, smoking a cigarette, and had clearly been drinking. She, Delia, had just gotten back from a vacation, so she's already exhausted. You know how you feel when you finally get home and you can kind of start to unwind, and then now this asshole is already here waiting for me. I already told you I don't want you to be around today. I said, you know what? John, I gotta go to bed. I gotta work in the morning, and I'm tired. Please just show yourself out and I'll leave. John absolutely loses his shit again.
Oh man, what does he do?
Delia goes into the bathroom to start winding down, getting ready for bed and stuff, and then no sooner than she shut the door, Sweeney fucking rips it off its hinges almost, just Hulk smash this door, get out here. He forces her out, throws her on the bed, grabs her by the ankles, and ties her to the bed misery style, to which Delia politely responds, "What the fuck are you doing?" He also ties her arms to the top of the bed frame, and she's trying desperately to get out, but he had it set up in such a way that if she struggled at all, it would only get tighter. And when he did the other arm, she didn't really bother putting up much of a struggle. There wasn't anything she could do. She could see how it was working, so she just kind of accepted it and wound up being there all night dealing with John's bullshit. By the next morning, her wrists were so swollen and purple that they left a mark for a week where she'd been tied up.
Hey, what was the nature of John's bullshit during this?
On to John's bullshit! He was prepared, which makes this all the more disgusting, but right behind the bed was a suitcase. Read, kill kit. And in that case there was a knife, K-N-I-F-E, with a poke poke here and a slice slice there. In that suitcase was a knife, and also a gun.
Hey!
Sorry, I had to break the tension a little bit because this is about to be gross, because he is about to begin the weirdest interrogation ever. Usually, when you interrogate someone, you're trying to extract information out of them. But he ties her up to the bed, holds her at knife point and gun point. If she struggles, it only gets worse and more tighter, and then John just starts confessing to wild shit. He screams out, "If you scream, I'll cut your tongue out! Now I suppose you wonder what happened to Melissa!" Delia is terrified and confused. Not a great couple of things to be simultaneously. So she's thinking, okay, why bring this up right now? I'm tied up and in pain. You bring up your ex. Why are you doing this right now? And he starts going through the details about what happened to Melissa. He said, "We had a room in Amsterdam. She had two Germans with her, and I killed them all. I didn't know what to do with the bodies for 3 days, and then on the third day, I cut them up and put them in bags and threw them in the canal." Why did he tell her all that? No one has any idea. Even at the time of the interview, the best anyone could figure out was that it was just pent up and he had to get it out. So the next day, as Delia is still tied up on the bed, the phone rings around noon coming from the kitchen. It's one of her co-workers calling to check in. You know, it's not like Delia to miss work and not call anyone. John is freaking out, and he comes rushing back into the room screaming, "Oh, what am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? Shit, shit, shit! Wait, you! You, what are you gonna do?" Delia's like, "Fuck, I don't fucking know, man. I've been tied up and dehydrated on the bed all goddamn night." So John has to think quickly or he's gonna get busted. So he says, I'll let you go. Just, call Rosie, call her back right now, and then tell her it's an emergency. So he walks her into the living room where the phone is. He kneels her down on the ground, probably so no one can see her through the window. She calls Rosie, and as calmly as she can, though her voice is still pretty shaky, tells her that there was an emergency, and she will return to work next Monday, but otherwise, she is fine, no need to worry. I'm good. She finally had a small glimmer of hope, just a speck of light that kind of brightened up the darkness a little bit, that phone call, but then, nope, he took that away too. And that's when she knew. She said she knew there was no way of trying to get away. I knew he could read my mind, and I didn't think of doing anything, and I knew better not to. He's very quick, and if I'd tried anything, I would have ended up cut up, or worse, or whatever. I knew better than to do and try anything. I wouldn't get away with it. I would have just been asking for trouble. That is one of the saddest and scariest things I think I've ever heard, to be that painfully self-aware of your own mortality and not having a way out is just, that's a shitty place to be.
I need a break.
I think I'm gonna agree with you there, Alex. It's time for a little palate cleanser. So, it's time for another random cat fact. I just happened to find an interesting cat fact while looking for non-cat related facts about London. Check this out. The British government has employed cats since the 16th century. The position is called the Chief Mouser to the Cabinet Office, and the current one is named Larry, who has been there since 2011 and outlasted 4 prime ministers. I love people names for pets.
Ooh, which ones?
David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, and Elizabeth Tuss.
Too bad ours will never amount to anything prestigious.
Oh, they're fine. I do make better biscuits than they do, but they make me laugh, so I guess that's a fair trade. Back to more of John's bullshit. He would just needle her all the time, too. He'd haphazardly pour tea from an expensive teapot she'd gotten from China. She'd tell him anytime he's pouring tea, hold the lid, you're gonna break it! And then he would just do that dickhead thing where he just lets the lid fall and then it shatters. Just...
Oh, you mean like this?
Probably exactly like that. And then she screams out, I fucking told you! What are you doing? And then he comes right back to with same energy, just shut up, bitch, don't make me angry! So even though he was doing nice things, he would do out-of-pocket shit like that all the time. Including making new cupboards one day. Check out what I did for you. These are real nice, aren't they? And then the next day he'd come in and just take his knife and just start scratching the shit out of the top of it. Like, what are you doing? Like, it just adds up and gets worse and worse and worse. Just these small little, I'm gonna say, microaggressions, even though I hate that phrase, but they kind of what they are. And so it just builds and builds and builds. And she wanted to get rid of him so badly, but was just too afraid to ask. Until finally one day, they'd gone to Germany together on a little trip, and she finally built up the courage to say what she wanted to say. A day trip to another country. I will never know what that's like. I'm in Texas. She told him that she doesn't want to come back home with her to the flat. She doesn't want him to come back with them. And probably the only reason that she felt safe enough to say anything is because of the hotel. They were in public. She was feeling a little bit extra confident because he's a little bit less likely to lash out violently, so that gave her the little boost that she needed. He says he'll go to Liverpool when they get back, and then they get back, and he just keeps stalling, and stalling, and stalling, and stalling. Oh, I'll go next week, or I'm busy this weekend, and I got too many jobs to do, and I'm too tired, and whatever, pick your excuse. He just doesn't leave. Delia knew she was in trouble. She just couldn't get out. And she can't even really call the police because that'll just make things worse because he'll want revenge. We've already had police interaction with this guy numerous times for the crazy violent shit he does, and he keeps coming back to the main part of the story. Police are not very helpful. And the first week of November, she came home on a Monday, and then just suddenly everything was gone. He was gone, all his stuff was gone, he left a note saying that fine, I've gone to Germany to go do some work. Cool. Except, there's something, an inkling, something in her gut just told her he's lurking around somewhere in London nearby. He's gotta still be here somewhere. So she changed the locks on Thursday, still didn't quite feel safe. Then on Friday, he broke in, discovered that the locks were changed, didn't like that one bit. Found out that she'd left a small window in the bathroom open, so he squeezed his way in through there and just waited and hid all day, like a spider would do, just waiting for Delia to come home, just like he did with Anne in the closet.
What crazy thing is he holding this time?
Delia returns home from work, walks in quietly. She's constantly worried that he might be there, just walking around any corner, and then suddenly, the bathroom door slams open. He slams her onto the floor, jams his finger down her throat, and starts screaming at her, "Are you gonna stop screaming?" She couldn't even speak through the excruciating pain, no idea why he's yelling those specific things out, but she just ekes out and, "Uh-huh," and then he took out his fingers and screams, "You bit me, you bitch!" And then everyone just starts screaming. Luckily, while this is going on, a concerned friend had called the cops for Delia out of concern. Just the stars aligned and it happened to work. She hadn't showed up to a planned event and was very aware of Sweeney's violent nature. Your friends are going to know that about your significant others. And then in the middle of this, the cops show up, knock on the door. Delia makes her way over to the peephole, sees it's holy shit, it's the cops, and just screams, "Help me!" and then bursts out the front door. They arrested Sweeney for assault and unlawful imprisonment. You kept me prisoner in my own home twice now. But again, domestic violence wasn't really looked at back then like it is today, so he's given the very harsh sentence of not only staying the fuck away from Delia, but he also cannot go within. Alex, give me a drum roll, buddy. 1 mile of her house. Take
what?
That, sir. Justice has been served. Good day. Delia's not overexcited about these conditions. That's not gonna fucking work. You guys, he's gonna be waiting, lurking somewhere. I can't just tell him if he shows up, "Oh, wait a second while I call the police." That's not gonna work. And from here, we have the events that took place during the cold open. Sweeney waited for her outside her home with the axe until she got home from work, attacked her from the darkness of the shrubberies. Her neighbor wailed on him with a bat for a little while. He ran away, and now he's gonna be on the run for the next 6 years and will pop back up in London under a new identity of Scouse Joe, or Joe Scouse. He has gotten really good at disguising himself, too. All of the photos this dude took look like completely different people. And while in London, he entangles himself with yet another woman who fell victim to his whimsical charms, Paula Fields, a 31-year-old mother who was doing pretty good and pretty happy with life until she fell on hard times, developed a crack cocaine addiction, and began taking up sex work to make ends meet. Their relationship would be the shortest of the three, but it was ripe with all the same types of unpleasantness. He had developed a seething rage for her, and on top of that, she was buying drugs from local dealers and giving them his name to collect payment from. And then one night, after he caught her rifling through his stuff trying to steal his phone, he lost it once again. He kills her, cuts off her head, hands, and feet, just like Melissa, chops her up, places the remains into 6 different hold alls, or over here we'd say a duffel bag, because we're classy like that, and then thrown it into the Regent's Canal in London. In February 2001, a few boys that had been fishing in the canal pulled up one of the bags, discovered what was inside, holy shit, it's a person, and immediately called the police. The newly discovered process of DNA identification was starting to gain traction right around this time, so that was very helpful, and they quickly identified the victim as Paula Fields. Holy crap, we have a lead. She was very quickly linked to Scouse Joe. Scouse Joe was quickly found out to be John Patrick Sweeney. And then, remember that other body in the canal in Rotterdam about 10 years ago that was just buried in an unmarked grave somewhere? Well, DNA had made a lot of progress at this point, and it wasn't completely unforgotten about, and they realized, wait a minute, this is real similar to the body we just identified. Let's check and see if we can find out who this person is. And they found out, boom, that's Melissa Halstead, a known associate of Sweeney. And after a very short international joint investigation, Sweeney is arrested. They were just posted up waiting for him at a job site, and then pounced on him the moment they entered the property. He was armed at the time with a gun and a knife, but otherwise went quietly. On March 5th, 2002, he is sentenced to a grand total of 4 life sentences for the attack on Delia. However, there is a small possibility of parole after 9 years. So they really need to prove that he murdered Paula and Melissa too.
How are they gonna do that?
Thankfully, somebody liked to draw things a lot. Who could that be? They examined one of the other pictures, and this one is, it looks like right in the middle is just a, like, sketch of Melissa, and there's a bunch of just random weird shit, like cats and glass beer bottles and other stuff all around the edges of it. Like a mosaic, almost. And then in the middle, right next to Melissa's head, they can see that there's a spot that had been used with, like, some correcting fluid, and then they used fancy lasers, whatever method they used to read underneath different layers of artwork, and they found it was a gravestone, and it said R.I.P. Melissa with her birthday, and then a question mark as her death day after that little dash, as well as, check this out, a crude poem on the back of a lottery ticket that said, "Poor old Melissa, chopped her up in bits. Food to feed the fish, Amsterdam was the pits." They also found a similar signature for Paula's murder on another drawing of his, and in 2011, He was sentenced to a whole life tariff, something only reserved normally for the worst of evil human beings, and it is there that he will remain until he dies. Sometime, hopefully, a long, long ways away off from right now. Just waste away in there until there's nothing left of you. It has recently come out that there were 3 more bodies that could possibly also be linked to Sweeney. There was a trainee nurse from Derbyshire named Sue, who hasn't been seen since the late 70s or 80s, as well as a Brazilian woman named Irani and a Colombian woman named Maria, both of whom went missing sometime in the late 90s and knew Sweeney while he was in London. Somebody better be dragging the river for duffel bags, but as far as I know, at this moment, no evidence has come forward to suggest anything further. It does seem suspicious that they all went missing and also knew John Patrick Sweeney, but can't say for sure. So that's the show, everybody. John Patrick Sweeney, the canal killer, will die behind bars at some point during our lifetimes, and I think the UK can rest a little bit easier with that monster safely tucked away behind bars. I know I'm saying that 13 years after the fact, but you know what? I'm trying to catch up with stuff, alright?
I enjoyed getting to talk a lot today.
Yes, I think I did too, actually. If you lovely people out there in listener world also enjoyed that, or any other aspect of this show, please let me know with a 5-star review or comment on whichever thing you're allowed to comment on this show for.
It really does help us out.
The algorithm demands engagement, so any extra engagement you can spare, it actually does help, so gets it in front of more people, and that gets more people listening to me, and then maybe telling some other people about it. You should do that too. But I'm honestly just glad you stuck around to the end today. This went on a lot longer than I initially thought it would. Normally, I try to do about 30 to 45 minutes, but we're over an hour at this point. I have to edit a little bit, but it'll be an hour long. So thanks for sticking out. Next week, I have another really crazy story to tell you about, and it is the inspiration for a cult classic horror movie. If you can guess what movie it is and send me a message on Instagram, @funnybaldwaiter, with the movie title, I'll give you a shout-out.
Ooh, listener incentive.
Otherwise, have a good week, make smart choices, and stay kind, everybody.
Bye!